SW Radio from SecurityInfoWatch.com. This is episode 27. This week's program is a much-belated podcast roundtable in conjunction with Security Dealer and Integrator Magazine in their April issue. They had a focus on school security systems. For this program, we brought in Dr. Adam Thermos, an independent consultant focusing on higher ed security solutions, Cindy Downing from Honeywell Security, and Andy Wren, president of Wren Solutions, which is a CCTV company that's formerly in retail space and really now working in the education space as well. We're going to go ahead and jump right into this discussion of school security. We're going to tackle everything from K through 12 to higher ed, and I hope you enjoy our program.
We're recording today a roundtable as part of Security and Dealer and Integrator Magazine's tie-in with Security InfoWatch's podcast series, a roundtable about school security, and we're going to cover K through 12 as well as higher education. We've brought in three folks today that I'll let you get to know first. We have Dr. Adam Thermos. He's a former professor for 20 years, and now he's a designer of access control and security and surveillance systems for higher education institutions. He's worked with schools like Brown University, Johnson & Wales, of course all the Ivy Leagues and some of the small Ivies as well. He's actually calling in from a college campus right now where we can assume he's working hard on their security. With us today also is Cindy Downing, education specialist on Honeywell's global accounts team. They're over there at Honeywell. They're doing access control, video analytics, video storage, and convergence solutions. Work with schools like Delaware State, Wright State, St. Louis University, and, of course, the K through 12 market. And also with us today is Andy Wren, president of Wren Solutions. He's worked with schools over the last 4 years. The company had traditionally been focused on retail, but now is trying to take that expertise and bring it to the schools market, doing everything from full site assessments to really presenting what they need to know about video surveillance. They're working mainly in the K-12 market, though they are getting into some of their higher education and the university and college levels. And, of course, we've got Deborah O'Mara with us today, editor of Security Dealer and Integrator Magazine, and I'm Jeff Cole, editor of SecurityInfoWatch.com. So we're going to get into our discussion, and the first thing we wanted to talk about was about threats and what are schools dealing with today. And I think let's think about the higher education, about the colleges and universities, and what kind of threats they're facing today. Adam, Dr. Adam, can you weigh in on this?
Sure. You can call me Adam direct. Dr. Thermos got stuck with me since the college days. Of course, the active shooter scenario is the scenario that really dominates the concerns in all campuses. A number of state and federal agencies already proceed with some remediation programs associated with response in terms of police force, management of the active shooter, management of weapons on campus. And that is pretty much what's dominating the discussion since VT, the incident in Virginia Tech, and the other incidents that they followed that. And the higher ed would have about 15 incidents after that. Some of them were published, some of them not, that they were copycats of what happened there with fewer numbers, of course, of victims. And that is the primary concern, at least on the visible side of the house. There are other concerns associated with theft of equipment and intellectual property, but these are invisible activities that they are impacting federal research money allocations. And as I mentioned before, intellectual property with biotech inventions in equipment and animal labs. That's what I see in my market anyway.
Andy, you've been focused heavily in the K through 12 market, working on video surveillance. With the school systems that you've worked with, what are they telling you that they're concerned about?
Well, I think it's similar to what Adam talked about. There are some kind of scorched earth scenarios that everybody has their major fears about, but it's more kind of getting their arms around what they can do, and in the K-12 environment being a little different. Many are not as campus structured, so the kind of free interchange of students between buildings is not as prevalent. So it's a lot of the things around unwanted behavior, some of those theft, vandalism, fight issues, things like that, as well as kind of managing towards that that ultimate bad news scenario. So what we find really is a lot of these folks are struggling right now, and because of these high profile incidences, they're being forced either through some of the school boards or parents themselves to, some for the first time, really develop a comprehensive security plan. So it's been, we kind of run the gamut from folks that have a really sound foundation that they're building from and then deploying tools accordingly to others that are frankly just looking for anybody to help do anything to quell some of the uproar that they're getting from the parents and the school boards.
With the when we talk about the schools, obviously budgets come to mind. Higher ed side, Cindy, what's happening in budgets?
Well, because the budgets are being strained right now, this is a time of economic concern, where people, when they're sending their students to school, I mean, they're having to pay the tuition and all the extra costs, so it's not as lucrative as it used to be. So the departments are actually, we're seeing them partner together. So you might see physical security partner with IT because they might have a better budget for IP cameras or security.
Now, are budgets being strained both at the higher ed level as well as the K-12? Or?
Yes.
Well, they're, yeah. They're, Cindy, can I talk?
Oh, go ahead, Dr. Thermos.
Yeah, I agree. There is a, in effect, as Cindy said, we don't have really segmentation of who owns what. These projects are cooperative efforts, mostly designed and driven by IT and with security basically following at the tail end of things. But most of the budgets are controlled by IT facilities because they control hardware and, of course, the networks. And the Dean of Students primarily concerned with policy and procedures and response operations on campus. And I would like to add to, I concur with my colleague that the schools are looking for a top-to-bottom new operations and procedures. And some of the budgets that they are spending, the K-12 people right now, they're coming out of cities and towns. But in order for this to happen, they have to be NIMS compliant. So you see a lot of administrators taking NIMS first responders courses for certification. And after that, they have some access to further federal funding for their projects.
Okay. So right now it sounds like schools are working on their security plan reviews, which obviously is the natural point before you start to make lots of technological expenditures.
Right.
So.
But in terms of operations, they have to be NIMS compliant.
Jeff, one of the things that we're seeing specifically in the K-12 space, which is a little bit eye-opening for us, I think, when we first kind of embarked upon K-12 as a market presence, is, this has become such a hot-button issue for so many schools and districts that the kind of sources of funds that are coming through are so varied, everything from grants to the traditional kind of bond structure to PTAs to operating budgets. I mean, the folks that are really kind of trying to make a movement forward, they're finding money. It's certainly tighter than it has been, in years past. But it is, the number one thing in that K-12 is they've got the safety and security responsibility for those students. So I think that's becoming more and more apparent to, creating that safe learning environment. You can't really teach if it's not safe. So that is something that we've seen too. That was a little unique and interesting, I think, when we first sat down and looked where these sources of funds were.
And I guess we have to imagine that for the school administrators, this is a very frustrating time where this is not their background of safety and security. This is the background of people like the three of you. But these school administrators are having to really get up to speed on that very quickly. In terms of also getting up to speed very quickly, the security integration community, the channel resellers and the security dealers that are out there to work with these schools are probably having to learn a lot about how to work with schools. Andy, you want to weigh in on some ideas on some things that they should know about working with schools?
Certainly. I mean, I think as with most situations and understanding your market, it's really getting a comprehensive overview of what they're trying to achieve. Everyone has fairly consistent high-level objectives when they're trying to deploy a security plan and the technology that falls out from that. But everyone is faced with different challenges, again, back to the kind of open campus versus closed building or the age of the building that may allow different kind of technologies to be deployed. So it's really, I think, getting a core understanding of what their big risk factors are. So it's all about developing this plan that's going to mitigate our risks. And it takes a lot of time on the front end, and it's time well spent, though, to do a real assessment of where those big risk points are so you can address them most specifically, because as budget is available, you want to be able to prioritize and make sure you're addressing things in an appropriate fashion, in an appropriate order.
Mm-hmm.
And, Cindy, yeah, I mean, yeah. At Honeywell, you guys have a strong affiliation with a lot of the reseller channels. What are some of the things that they've had to learn that you've heard about?
Well, I have to agree with Andy in that one of the first things I learned in the education market is the challenge to provide security in an open learning environment. And a lot of these campuses are very liberal places. Some of them don't even allow CCTV cameras.
That's actually one of the topics we did want to cover. And let's jump into that. Let's talk about, you know, video.
Well, let's jump into that just a little to bring another little light on this thing. Some schools really lock down, period. And their single points of entry, at least the school districts I work for, they were looking for single points of entry, total lockdown of their buildings, escorted visitations outside. And the monies are not coming anymore from the schools. They're coming from the towns themselves because, as you mentioned, and I agree with Andy and Cindy, the administrators, they find themselves at a state of shock when they find out now not only they have to deal with the medical emergencies for the kids, but they have to put in a role of law enforcement and prevention. We are establishing very tight connections with the town and the city police departments or the town police departments. And many times we're sending straight video to the police direct under the same budget so that they can share some responsibilities and some of the burdens, if you wish, of this situation. And this is happening in other sectors as well. I mean, the low-income housing, housing projects, HUD structures inside the cities, they do the same thing. So an infrastructure is being created silently on background, but very, very aggressively, particularly with mass wireless networks, where you see police operations being able to access K-12 university campuses, perimeter, of course, parking lots, not inside, as well as HUD areas.
Adam, did you say that they're able to access the outside video and not the inside video at these schools?
Right. It's a great reluctance still from a lot of this. I mean, they can retrieve the video anytime they want to, but on a day-to-day operations, primarily they're looking at the perimeter parking lots and adjacent streets.
Okay. Well, let's talk about video systems inside of schools. And I guess the first thing we should think about is where are schools electing to place these systems? Is it primarily going on outside, or is it the hallways, or is it their mix? And what would you recommend to different schools as far as way to start?
It's supposed to be a couple of schools of thought here is whether or not the system should be visible or invisible. The reality is we would like to have the prevention effect, so we would like the cameras to be visible. At least my designs, all cameras are very visible, and we observe signage as well, like space under surveillance or camera in operation, just generic statements. Of course, we don't make a claim that it's monitored 24/7. But in terms of specific locations, we pick up the incidents reporting first, and we cover the areas that they have most of the incidents the year before, like parking lots or remote or dark stairwells or areas that they present special need based on special records. And then, of course, we try to blanket some areas, so perimeter of the building, main hallways, main office, and we marry a lot of these cameras with the card access systems in the front doors or what doors they have associated with card access or door contacts, so we have a good picture of what's going on. Now, truth to be told, I mean, none of these things are monitored 24/7. I mean, it's impossible. But you can always retrieve information in case of litigation or in case of evidentiary needs for, you know, investigation purposes.
Right, and if you did have a Sentinel incident, assuming you could, like you said, either pipe that video perhaps to police, if that kind of solution is was built into it, or maybe, you know, get into the control room and start watching the video that's not normally watched. We've all talked a little bit about how the sort of the mass shooting incidents have reshaped campus security. Has it, Cindy or Andy, has it reshaped how campuses are using video surveillance? Are they changing the way they use it?
My perspective is that, you know, again, everybody kind of, that's the headline grabber, but it's, thankfully, that's not as prevalent as many of the other incidences, and hopefully we can, through education and some of the other tools that are going on, minimize some of those catastrophic events. But it's really, it is more about, you know, what we're seeing the move towards. We talked a little bit about convergence and network videos, so leveraging some of the kind of infrastructure and technologies that will allow you to do things like one of the higher ed's schools that we're working with, they are for the first time kind of setting up a central command and control center, not necessarily to be monitored 24/7, but at certain times when they can kind of augment their on-campus resources so they can deploy more efficiently. You know, video is really such a powerful tool because as humans we often process visually, so having the ability to be in more places at one time is really important. And I think, as Adam said too, the integration effort into other systems, be it access or analytics or other things, that can kind of trigger, you know, and refocus with video is something that we're seeing a big movement towards.
I definitely agree with Andy on that. Lately we are searching, at least I'm searching, and Cindy can sympathize with that. I'm looking for analytics that they make sense, both in terms of pricing, licensing, and implementation. Behavior analytics, which takes specific behaviors on campus, customize them, and place them on the system so that only specific alarms and specific video is broadcasted. But definitely video has become the predominant tool, jumping ahead of access control, as a matter of fact, in a number of installations as phase one. And that is a trend that I see continuing. I was involved in England with some of their installations, and of course the English have gone overboard with 600,000 cameras in London and 7 million cameras around the country. But I hope we never reach that level, but certainly the need was getting pretty apparent early in the game, and as of 3 years ago, we were fighting privacy faculty committee members associated with, you know, installing videos in the perimeter doors in the front entries, and today we don't even consider that as an issue, although in our policy and procedures we definitely, you know, deal with these issues and provide some recommendations of who has the authority to do what and why. But video really is driving a lot of the installations today.
So the entryways is no longer a privacy issue, but is it safe to say that putting cameras inside of classrooms is still a red flag privacy issue for the teachers and staffers?
Not really. I mean, no. We used to have traditionally put cameras for unattended labs, like not bio labs, just computer labs. So we can avoid vandalism of theft of computers or keyboards or DIMMs, which is the favorite target today. Basically, the kids open the back of the computer and take out the DIMMs in terms of memories. But hallways today, they are open space. We have no issues there. Some of the university designs that we're involved with, particularly in the South, we're using cameras in the hallways of the dorms something we don't do here in the Northeast. But based on the incidents that they were, not so much heavy crime, but even vandalism associated with the hallways and dorms, yes, we put, cameras in the hallways. And in the academic areas associated with the galleries of arts, exhibit halls, and so forth, yes, they're in the hallways, they're everywhere. They're wide, day-night, wide dynamic cameras, color. And this is where Cindy's items are coming to play, because they have some specialty devices that I enjoy using myself.
Cindy, you mentioned that that Honeywell has worked extensively with the K-12 market. Are privacy issues more of a concern there?
Yes, they are, particularly because these are students of younger ages and to have privacy issues. So yes, that's a big concern. To add to what Dr. Thermos was mentioning earlier too about the video analytics and using that for our campus security, the analytics has become so sophisticated now that we're actually able to detect camera sabotage. So if someone blacks out a camera or changes the field of view, then that's something that can be immediately downloaded to or pushed out to a PDA, so someone can know that right away and make an assessment. It can also do things as noticing if people are going from left to right, that's fine, but if they go top to bottom or vertical, then that's something else too, and also detect movements on roofs. So there are other things so there are a lot of applications for the video analytics as well in the security market.
Well, and you're talking about people on roofs and movement around. I mean, college campuses especially, probably more so than the K-12 market, are known for having students with a lot of energy, a lot of creativity, and they do things like prop open doors to let their friends in at the dorms generally kind of a tough audience when it comes to security systems. How does that shape access control?
Well, you can obviously activate an annoying alarm if a door is held open. They'll just to keep it from annoying them.
Yeah.
Well, to expand on Cindy's argument here, yeah, access control. Basically, local audibles are creating an annoyance, but lately when we are tying into the video surveillance component, then you have pretty much a record of who's processing doors and who's propping doors and who's forcing doors. We have a unique design just rolled up last month, actually, at the University of Arizona that we have allowed the, of course, at quite a cost in terms of licensing on the software side. We allow the residential directors to access video-wise their own building's doors, so they can have access to their doors as well as Police Central. When an alarm is associated with a door, prop door, arrays, they have become a first responder in the situation to close the door, kick the brick out, without having to a cruiser to respond to that incident. And has become quite a successful enterprise, because we took the pressure off the police department and distributed it to the owners and users themselves.
Now, when I went to college, we still had keys. These days, students in college and university tend to have an ID card. What's happening in terms of ID badging and how that's applied to access control?
A lot of things are happening. I don't want to monopolize that. If anybody wants to jump on it, because there's a lot of things happening here on this world on the ID side. Andy, you want to jump in it, or?
You know, that's something that we're seeing as well, is kind of different technology.
I mean, they,
go ahead.
Right. The one-car programs that I was talking to you about, they're dominated by five or six major manufacturers in the United States for 7,000 schools. So, in effect, these are the dining, vending, declining balance programs with the HID proxy cards that you see, or the dual prox or the MagSwitch. Of course, nobody's using MaxWaves anymore. Everybody's on the proxy environment, proximity, but the MaxWaves are still used for the online transaction processing. Now, and the technology has moved really fast because it's more or less of a database management at this point. Oracle panel databases directly communicate with the access control or dining vending operations. So commands and programs, they're being cascading down to the level of who is authorized to access specific door without really having to program this thing manually. And the cards now, they are moving into the interior doors. You know, you probably had the interior suites or the interior dorms, and you can see a lot of both wired and wireless standalone systems proliferating from the simple hotel lookalike systems on MaxWipe Track 3 all the way to more sophisticated wireless online systems that they are working straight off the proxy environment of the card itself. And these are very nice systems because cost-wise, they're about $500, $600, $700 a door versus the online systems that are about $5,000, $6,000 a door. So you see a lot of this, you see the direction that the card environment on campus is pushing technology. Don't forget, you never get rid of the mechanical keys, but now you're using them as key override for emergency situations only. So that's where we are on that.
Now, one of the other things that we spoke about a little bit before the call started was that the lockdown mindset is being replaced by the shelter-in-place. Cindy, I wonder if you could kind of give us a little introduction on what's happening in terms of shelter-in-place for college campuses.
Sure. The campus security folks have actually, they're avoiding using the term of lockdown. Because when they lock the doors, they're not really certain if they're locking students out of getting shelter or if they're locking the shooter in. So rather than say, she's using the word shelter in place, which means to seek shelter.
I agree with that. The term, pretty much Cindy is correct, is shelter in situ. Which means same place. It's utilized some schools. Well, the problem with a lot of schools here, particularly K-12, is whether or not they're going to use electronic lockdown of the interior classroom doors or mechanicals and how they manage that and what operations they have in place when they have to unlock these doors and how do they verify who is on the outside. A lot of policies are in place, various levels of sophistication, and various levels of budgets. Of course, the most expensive option is the electronic one, a locking of all doors. And the less expensive is the mechanical keys, and I see more and more of the K-12s. They migrate slowly, but first of all, they go into the mechanical lock key configurations for the teacher. Upon an alarm that's been issued on his pager or through the intercom, or he's pushing the button, basically locking the door. Everybody moves away from the door and exposed location windows in safe spaces, and they wait until the alarm is off, and that's happening on an individual basis per classroom with an identifiable sign or identifiable person from the outside of the police officer. I mean, it is a policy that is migrating because it's incident-based policy. We cannot predict the future, what the future is going to bring, but that's what I see in most of the installations on that.
Or the mechanical systems. What advantage would an electronic system give in that kind of situation?
Now, the management, Cindy, you want to jump in?
The system can be configured to actually lock all the doors at one time, or they can lock certain regions at one time.
Correct.
The question is, they don't know who they're locking in and who they're locking out.
Correct.
So it needs to have some flexibility to that, I guess.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much that you have an active shooter on a K-12, although a lot of kids in California are doing just that now. Most of the problems we have in K-12 is a restraining order enforcement, divorce situations, and children abduction. That's number one concern. And the second concern, of course, is, as I said, just criminal activity with a the kid bringing a gun on school and playing with it.
If an incident does occur, one of the big pushes that schools have had lately has been to enable and install mass notification systems. Cindy, your company has such a system. What's happening with mass notification systems on at both the K-12 as well as the college campuses?
In weird approach, sometimes I think people think that mass notification is just simply cell phone texting or emailing, but it isn't. It's actually an entire program of including newspaper, radio, TV news, the community involved, as well as the alertus boards, the code blue phones. So it's a whole process rather than just one particular solution, one size.
And in terms of when schools are choosing these type of systems, is it an a la carte where they can where maybe some schools only buy the loudspeakers and some buy the loudspeakers and the cell phones, some buy loudspeakers, cell phones, and the computer sort of over control?
Yes, they can, and some programs include all those, and some programs do not.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of what they want to use it for. If they only want to use it for emergency purposes, or if they want to use it for normal use, such as schools closed due to snow or other reasons for that.
Hey, Cindy, can I ask you a question on the mass notification, especially in the higher ed environment? What are you seeing on the programs that are much more focused on, you know, kind of text and email and some of those communication tools to the students that require kind of an optional opt-in? Because a few of the folks that we've talked to in higher ed are having a tough time getting their students really to kind of, even if it's, I don't call students lazy because I was the prototype for that probably, but to really kind of take advantage of the situation. What do you see with that today?
Well, you have to consider, too, the profile of the student, is that when the students go to school and they get the email address of the university or the college, they may or not use that. They're probably going to use their Gmail address. So that's one hole right there. And also the cell phone numbers. You know, students change cell phone numbers. So unless they actually go online to some web interface and their new cell number, then how do they know they're going to get these notifications? So there are still a lot of considerations that have to be taken into account for mass notification. It's not just a one thing, which is why the campus security folks are actually looking at layered ways to contact the students and the staff.
Yeah, I agree with Cindy 100% on that. We got serious problems with the kids stolen to register in the university.net type of notification system. Although we buy these things by the bustle, because really they are inexpensive to purchase and easy to install, it's a web-based, most of them web-based, and most of them do broadcast in different media. The problems that we have, and I have in particular, is what actually we are broadcasting. We had incidents like a robbery in town may trigger a notification and lockdown of schools, which is totally unrelated to their environment. So in effect, the administrators at this point, they're trying to figure out the golden rule, if you wish, what do we broadcast and what we don't? I mean, what's a critical event, what is not? And this critical event, of course, is sent to the parents, the cell phones, the text, or voicemail, if you wish, everywhere. So that is some of the issues that I'm dealing with on this part of the technology. Are you there?
With notification systems, what is, if you have a really full system, you know, one that can do, of course, you know, loudspeakers, cell phones, email alerts, what kind of a percentage of students are you trying to reach? Are you trying to reach 10%, 50%, 90%, 100%? What's reasonable?
We don't have percentages, you know, at least in our campuses. We blanket the entire student population. We're not really segmented yet. We don't know if we're going to do it in the future, but certainly we don't say, for example, the bio students or the engineering students or undergraduate or graduate students or
no,
dorm
I guess,
students.
I guess what I'm asking is what's your goal in terms of if you send this out to all students, what percentage of them do you really think are getting these messages?
I don't have statistics right now. I know that all the systems require you to respond within a minute with a callback to verify you received the message and a specific number that is associated with a website that broadcasts the system, the message. I can pull some statistics, but I don't have them handy right now. I know we ran a test 3 days ago. Abbott Smith, everybody got it, but how many people really responded to this call, I have no idea.
Yeah, I guess that's the question. Of course, again, students are not maybe always the most faithful users of security. So,
that's true.
One of the big things we've talked about are systems integration. We certainly talked a lot about integrating video with access control and access control with card usage like financial services or dining. What else is happening, Cindy, Andy, and Adam, in terms of integration of technology that relates to security on campuses today?
We're actually working with a convergence platform, which is it links physical security with network security for logical security. So what that means is, for example, a very simple workflow that could be generated is a faculty person or a student would actually have to swipe into a building before they can log on to the lab PC, because logically they would have had to get into the building. So another one is when a student or a faculty person is registered, then they're immediately provisioned to get their network log on, their dorm access, cafeteria, library, the one card, but it also propagates their network security as well. So the benefit of that is, say that everybody is in the system, but then you have a disgruntled student or a disgruntled employee, then in one motion you can actually take those people out of not only just physical security but of network security applications as well.
Gotcha. Andy, on the video side, any interesting integrations that you've heard of?
Well, I think, a lot of the folks, we're talking about kind of the full gamut of technology and different levels of sophistication. The majority of people that we deal with, frankly, are still kind of doing some of the base foundational work, trying to get their core systems up, so access and video certainly. I think it's more geared around the movement towards tools, be it even simple integration, perhaps between just video and access, for instance, that are more proactive in nature. So there's rule sets that are driving more of the value and more efficiently, allowing people to respond more efficiently. So I think that's kind of that general premise of having technology kind of point you in the right direction so you can work more efficiently, and the things that are a higher level risk factor to tackle those first is what we see.
Gotcha. And, of course, that does make sense. Adam, how about on your end, any unique?
Yeah, I'd like to expand on what Andy said, which is true. Basically, I'm itching to myself to implement campus-wide IP addressable systems straight on the net with intelligent cameras. I was never able to do that, not only because of the monies and the licensing costs associated with the systems, but most of the clientele is still more comfortable in the analog environment of the IG59s and cable runs to locations. So most of my designs, basically, they backtrack. They return back to a hybrid environment with some IP components and a lot of analog components on the cameras themselves. And I would like also to add on the convergence situation that Cindy was talking about. Convergence has been the holy grail for about 5 years and still can't get off the ground as fast as, some of us would want to see it. And although we have great strides with the use of smart chip cards, basically PKI cards with 2Ks or 16Ks chips that on a wireless environment or a proxy environment can play two roles, access control, of course, and then access into your database itself. we had limited success with the IT departments, but hopefully this is going to come to play a little more in the future. So we're pretty much in a traditional market environment right now, still on hybrid surveillance systems with fully distributed DVRs or DVNs in the field and IP addressable, of course, and the cameras, mostly analogs, not only due to cost, but also due to the fear of the IT departments of the utilization rates of their network on a streaming video through them. So that's the picture we have.
That's okay. Interesting, Adam, on the video side. One of the things that we see, and I think we certainly see some of that more in higher ed, I think, when there's the K-12 environment, there's typically, you know, a school resource officer, but there's not a director of security per se. So
right.
Principal. So it's what we've seen is, from a network video perspective, it's really been embraced even more so because, you know, ultimately, even in the old days of an analog or a DVR environment, it ultimately fell on the director of IT, who didn't really know what he was dealing with this black box
right.
corner. And so those guys have really kind of, I guess, embraced the fact that they now kind of understand that there's a network device over their infrastructure with application software. So it fits their model better, and they feel comfortable. And the folks that are fairly progressive with their IT initiatives anyway, that we've worked with have really kind of gone forward, and they feel like they can now actually leverage the system of video specifically across their district more efficiently than they had in the past, so there's a comfort level. So, but I certainly agree with you. There are certain instances where if there's not the sophistication in IT and you know, a dedicated VLAN or something like that to minimize some of those IT concerns and security issues, there's a lot of consternation.
Well, there's no question, Andy, that when the video surveillance is driven by IT, they will give you a VLAN and go to a centralized facility for transmission. Most of the litigation that's come down the pike in the university world is associated with what's happening when you lose network. And at that point, all cameras go blank. That's why they're still, at least on the design side, stay with distributed recording devices in different buildings, different sites. So at least I don't lose the videos coming into the central storage facilities. But again, this is neither here nor there. I mean, the small high school is easier to network online all the time than having 500 buildings within a campus environment that they try to do the same thing. So it's cheaper to do network, no question about it. But if the network is lost, then basically they fly blind.
Well, we've covered a lot of topics today, and you know, hopefully
I wanted to just pipe in here for just one quick question, if I could, Jeff. This is Deborah.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering what the participants' thoughts are on the recent high school closings in the Chicago area. They've had some threats. I think they were email or phone in threats, and the schools immediately closed campuses. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that particular method.
My thoughts, I think it's, you see, we're losing perspective here. I mean, it's almost like the no tolerance policy applied in the schools. We're going from A to Z without really getting the permutations between A to Z. Shutting down entire schools simply because some calls came in pretty much dramatizes a threat that may not be there. And the second time the threat occurs, nobody takes it seriously. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that going into the zero tolerance policy, I think I found this policy is quite juvenile. But nevertheless, the school administrators like them because it gets them off the liability issue, but I don't think they serve the population as well.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Adam. I think it's kind of a scary precedent that, you know, you've kind of got things kind of upside down. I think it's, to your point, from a liability perspective, or, you know, maybe it's masking the fact that there's not a great plan in place take the kind of steps necessary to vet through that threat and make sure you've got the, you know, in a good, robust security plan, you've got measures that you can take to kind of minimize risks and for how real those are. So I agree. I think it's kind of scary that we have these knee-jerk reactions where we just start, closing the doors, and it's going to spiral out of control if it doesn't stop.
Correct, correct. And you see, and that is interesting because liability is driving a lot of, or threat of liability is driving a lot of these issues. Take a look at what's happening in Washington, D.C. schools. Basically, they're going to be shut down. They're going to be farmed out to a nonprofit to be run outside of whatever is supposed to be the D.C.-funded system. I mean, it's a lot of privatized in this. So I see a lot of schools, some schools in New York, and some districts going straight on that model, too. In Massachusetts, of course, we have the charter schools. Chicago, I don't have much hope. Probably they're going to end up doing the same thing. Other places as well, Connecticut, maybe some of the schools there too.
In terms of these policies, it seems like there's a lot that that schools have to weigh in on and make decisions on policy decisions that they've never really had to think about before, such as, you know, when do you, you know, shut down the school fully and send everyone home? How long do you record your video? You know, and these are decisions that, again, you know, some of the administrators haven't always haven't had to make in the past. So it's a great learning experience. But hopefully, we've also provided a learning experience here on this podcast program. Of course, big thanks to Dr. Adam Thermos, Cindy Downing, and Andy Wren. Let's see, if you want to reach Cindy Downing at Honeywell, that's www.security.honeywell.com. For Dr. Adam Thermos, that's Dr. D.R. Thermos, T-H-E-R-M-O-S.com. And Andy is with Wren Solutions at WrenSolutions.com.
Again, big thanks to Dr. Thermos, Cindy Downing, and Andy Rand for coming on the program, of course, for Deborah O'Mara, help us host this program. This, again, if you're looking for additional content on this topic, the April issue of Security Dealer and Integrator, which is, of course, online at securityinfowatch.com, if you don't have a copy, covers the issues of school security and really focus on, you know, how security systems integrators and, to some extent, maybe the end users should be approaching this topic. We're going to actually jump right back into this next week with another SDI, Security Dealer and Integrator Roundtable. And so stay tuned for that and our podcast series.